everyone, and welcome to today's episode of Brains Discussing Brains. Today we're going to be talking all about dopamine. Dopamine has many functions in the nervous system, and we'll try and cover most of them here today. We'll talk about the dopaminergic pathways and their functions, as well as the roles of dopamine as a neurotransmitter and its roles in reward, addiction, and disease. For the last section on disease, we'll actually hear from our first guest host, Ferran, a fellow UCL neuroscience student. So let's start this episode off by introducing the molecule. Dopamine is one of two catecholamine neurotransmitters, along with norepinephrine. It's synthesized from DOPA, which originally comes from the amino acid tyrosine. But we didn't always know that dopamine was a neurotransmitter. We originally thought that the only function of dopamine in the brain was to act as a metabolic precursor for norepinephrine. But of course, we now know that it's a crucial CNS neurotransmitter. This discovery was so crucial, in fact, that it won a Nobel Prize in Medicine in the year 2000. So where exactly do we find these dopaminergic neurons? Well, we find them throughout the CNS, such as in the retina or the olfactory bulb, although we do commonly think of the four dopaminergic pathways when we think of dopaminergic neurons. These four main pathways are the mesolimbic, mesocortical, nigrostriatal, and tuberoinfundibular. And although their names seem complicated, their names do roughly reflect their anatomical positions in the brain. So let's look at these four pathways in a little bit more detail, and we'll start with the mesolimbic system. The mesolimbic pathway connects the ventral tegmental area, often referred to as the VTA in the midbrain, to the nucleus accumbens. This means that the cell bodies of the dopaminergic neurons are in the VTA, while their projections synapse onto the nucleus accumbens. As the name mesolimbic implies, this pathway is found in the limbic system. The VTA sits at the top of the brainstem, and the nucleus accumbens sits a little bit higher towards the face, roughly above the pituitary gland. This pathway is thought to be involved in addiction and reward, because in the nucleus accumbens, or NA, dopamine is thought to mediate feelings of pleasure and reward. But we'll dive into that a little bit later. For now, let's move on to the next pathway, the mesocortical dopaminergic system. This one also originates in the VTA, or ventral tegmental area, but it projects to various points in the prefrontal cortex. You may remember that the prefrontal cortex is involved in cognition, working memory, and decision-making. Because the VTA houses dopaminergic neurons from both the mesolimbic and mesocortical pathways, we sometimes combine these two into the mesocorticolimbic dopamine system. So next up we have the nigrostriatal dopamine system, and this one is important. It contains 80% of all the dopamine in the brain. It originates in the substantia nigra and projects to parts of the basal ganglia, such as the dorsal striatum, ergo the name, nigrostriatal pathway. This one will be important later as well, as it is involved in motor planning and other types of purposeful movements. And then lastly, we have the tuberoinfundibular pathway, which begins in the acuate and periventricular hypothalamic nuclei, and then projects to the median eminence of the hypothalamus. This one is often forgotten, but it's not in any way less important, as it links to the pituitary hormone release through the median eminence. So now that we've briefly introduced the dopaminergic pathways, as well as their general functions, let's look at the roles of dopamine in both reward and addiction. And I think the best way to do this is to look at a few key experiments. Let's start with an experiment done by James Olds and Peter Milner in the 1950s. For this experiment, they implanted electrodes into the brains of rats. Rats were allowed to freely walk around a small box, but if they walked into a specific corner, the scientists would deliver brain stimulation through these implanted electrodes. They also did this experiment with a similar setup, where the rats could press a button of sorts to receive the same brain stimulation. We refer to this as self-stimulation, and the scientists noticed that in both setups, when stimulation was received by specific areas of the brain, the rats would self-stimulate relentlessly. Some rats would even forgo eating and drinking just to press the button or remain in that specific corner of the box. So what brain areas incited this behavior specifically? Well, most of this behavior was elicited by stimulation to the VTA that we mentioned before, the ventral tegmental area. This was the origin of dopaminergic neurons for the mesocortical and mesolimbic pathway. Furthermore, when the rats were administered dopamine receptor antagonists, so blocking dopamine receptors, they tended to self-stimulate much less. This finally led to the conclusion that the behavior the rats were exhibiting was motivated by nothing other than dopamine release, and thus, indirectly, that dopamine release reinforces the behaviors that cause it in the first place. This was a key experiment for demonstrating the role of dopamine in reward, but other experiments have shown that dopamine's role is a bit more complex, So let's look at an experiment that describes dopamine's role in not just reward, but reward prediction. This experiment was done by Wolfram Schultz at the University of Cambridge and monitored the activity of dopamine neurons in the VTA in monkeys. Monkeys were first shown a light turning on and then received a sip of juice. In the first few trials, the monkeys hadn't yet associated the light cue with the juice, so their dopaminergic neurons had no response to the light, but a brief response to the juice. After a while, the association built up and the monkeys learned that the light cue would mean a sip of juice. And so interestingly, their dopaminergic neurons now activated when the light was turned on, but no longer when the juice was administered. Sometimes the scientists tricked the monkeys and showed them a light but gave them no juice, and in these situations, dopaminergic neuron firing decreased in subsequent trials. Their conclusion was that if an event has a reward that is better than we expect, our dopaminergic neurons will start firing in response to that event. So in the case of the monkeys, this was firing during the light turning on. If an event has a reward that is exactly what we expected it would be, there is no change in firing. And if an event is a bit disappointing, dopaminergic neurons are inhibited. In this way, we will repeat behaviors that had better rewards than we expected and lose motivation to repeat behaviors that had disappointing results. So with the results of studies like these, we can argue that dopamine not only plays a role in reward, but predicting what rewards we get and reinforcing these behaviors. Now, these studies may have been done on rats and monkeys, but it's not that hard to find real-life examples of these kind of behaviors in humans. Let's say that you're at work, and you're not allowed to eat at work, but you know that the moment you leave work and go home, there'll be a nice warm meal waiting for you at home. So all you do for the last few hours of your shift is think about that nice warm meal you'll get to. Obviously, this seems like a reward, so you'll probably have some dopamine release when thinking about the food. So the question is, when you get home and actually eat the meal, is that the reward? Or was the reward simply thinking about the food and longing for it? Which of the two do you think caused more dopamine release? This could be something similar to the monkeys in the light. At first, dopamine release was when they received the sip of juice, but as they learned to associate it with the light, dopamine was released when the light was turned on, and no longer when they drank the juice. So that might mean that in some situations, like for example thinking about a hot meal, we get that dopamine release because we're associating it with that future reward. It has become to us what the light was to the monkeys. The second study about reward prediction might also help explain a phenomenon I'm sure many students have experienced. You studied hard for a test, you did your best, you expected a good grade, and when the results came back, they were less than ideal. This puts you in a slump, and you find it difficult to find the motivation to study for future exams. Well, according to the conclusions drawn by these studies, that might not entirely be your fault. You expected a high reward and thus lots of dopamine release, but this was less than expected. And so your dopaminergic neurons will decrease firing as well. So this behavior is no longer reinforced, and while that doesn't mean you should stop studying when you get a bad grade for a test, at least you can rest easy knowing that it may not be entirely your fault that you're lacking motivation. It may just be the way your dopaminergic system is wired. So now that we've talked a little bit about the dopaminergic system in relation to reward, let's talk a little bit about addiction. Obviously, these two do lie hand in hand a little bit, because addiction often comes from seeking reward. Addictive substances have been around forever. They're found in nature, for example, in opium poppies, tobacco, or the coca plant. It's us humans who have purified these substances to use as medicinal and recreational drugs. These addictive drugs act on different neurotransmitter systems in the brain. For example, heroin from opium poppies acts on the opiate system, nicotine from tobacco acts on the nicotinic and cholinergic systems, and cocaine from the coca plant acts on the dopaminergic and noradrenergic systems. And despite these differences, the actions of all these drugs are somehow related to dopamine. This is because the drug-seeking behavior that accompanies these drugs is mediated by the dopaminergic pathways that we discussed earlier. A study from the late 90s from Concordia University tried to localize where this drug-seeking behavior was generated. They did this by injecting microinfusions of drugs directly into different areas of the brain. The rat brain, that is, I should note, not the human brain. This study showed that the main site of action for heroin and nicotine is the VTA, or ventral tegmental area, whereas the main site of action for cocaine is the nucleus accumbens. Neurons in the VTA have a lot of opiate and nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, thus offering a good binding site for heroin and nicotine. By agonizing the dopaminergic neurons in the VTA, These drugs release dopamine in the nucleus accumbens, an area of the prefrontal cortex, through the aforementioned mesocorticolimbic dopamine system. Drugs like cocaine take a slightly different approach, as they prolong the action of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens, meaning that, directly or indirectly, all three drugs in some way increase levels of dopamine in the brain. This is what lies behind drug-seeking behaviors and addiction. But if we overstimulate our dopaminergic pathway, we don't get the same rewards over time. As dopamine levels increase, our reward system downregulates, which in the case of drugs leads to a drug tolerance. This means that over time, an individual will have to take bigger and bigger doses of the drug to receive the same effect, with that effect being dopamine release. But this downregulation also has another consequence. If an addicted animal stops receiving drugs, their levels of dopamine release are much lower compared to their pre-addictive state. This can cause withdrawal after drug use, which is often accompanied by symptoms that tend to be the opposite of the symptoms of the drug. Many effects of withdrawal can be explained by too little dopamine in the brain, and can thus sometimes, partly at least, be treated with dopamine agonists. So that was a little bit about dopamine in addiction. So before I hand off to our guest host, Ferran, to talk about the role of dopamine in disease, I thought it might be fun to run through a few recent studies that I collected regarding dopamine. The breadth of these studies shows that dopamine plays a wide range of roles, and they'll give us some insights into what new areas the field is looking into. So the first interesting study I found is from this year, 2022, and was done by Hasegawa et al. And published in Science. This paper looked at the role of dopamine in REM sleep, REM standing for rapid eye movement. During sleep, the brain cycles through REM and non-REM sleep stages, although it wasn't clear how the brain cycles from one stage to the other. We did, however, in previous studies, see activation of the amygdala when cycling from REM to non-REM sleep. So for this study, Hasegawa et al. Used fiber photometry, which is a calcium imaging technique. This technique lets you look at the activity of neurons, so if you're looking at dopaminergic neurons, you can indirectly gauge dopamine levels. The study found that when non-REM sleep terminates and REM sleep starts, dopamine levels transiently increase in the basolateral amygdala. This short increase in dopamine activates neurons in the basolateral amygdala as they express dopamine D2 receptors, thus initiating the REM sleep phase. This finding could provide useful insights into the symptoms of Parkinson's, as many patients with Parkinson's experience insomnia and fragmented sleep. Another interesting study that I found was also published in 2022 in Nature Metabolism by Luquet and Gangarosa. This study concluded that dopamine is to blame for the intense food cravings that many women experience during pregnancy. To be specific, they pinpointed neurons that express dopamine D2 receptors in the reward system as being the ones that mediate these behaviors. So for the study, they first developed a mouse model and looked at pregnant mice and their cravings for sweet food, as well as behaviors such as overconsumption. And although at first glance it may seem logical, this compulsive eating could simply be to provide the growing embryo with the energy it needs. But a control in this study disproved this notion. Pseudo-pregnant mice, so these are mice that were mated with vasectomized males and were thus not actually pregnant, also exhibited similar cravings. Furthermore, fMRI studies showed that during pregnancy, the functional connectivity of the reward circuit in the female pregnant mice was altered. You may remember this from earlier if you paid attention, but the reward circuit consists primarily of the VTA, the substantia nigra, and the nucleus accumbens. Thus, modified dopamine signaling may be to blame for the strange cravings for jars of peanut butter or chocolate that many pregnant women seem to experience. The last new development that I'd like to bring up is the role of dopamine in the immune system. While we've discussed dopamine in the central nervous system today, it's important to note that dopamine also regulates immune cells. Many immune cells express dopamine receptors, and some can even synthesize and secrete the transmitter. For example, peripheral blood dendritic cells, they express dopamine receptors and can even produce dopamine to activate its own receptors, which you may remember is called autocrine signaling. So far, research into this area is quite limited, but it does mean that we might attempt to treat immune system dysfunction with dopamine agonists or antagonists in the future. Personally, I thought this was very interesting, so if you want to read a little bit more about this, I recommend the 2022 review in Elsevier by Lee et al. So that was it for my section on all about dopamine. I'll now hand off to a fellow UCL neuroscience nerd, Ferran, to hear a little bit about the role dopamine plays in various diseased states. And I'll see you back here for the conclusion.
Problems with dopamine and dopaminergic pathways have been linked to various diseases, such as schizophrenia, Parkinson's, and disorders such as ADHD. Let's take a look at these diseases in a bit more detail. Firstly, schizophrenia comes from the Greek word schizen and phren, which mean split and mind, respectively. It reflects that we see it as a disorder of fragmented mental thinking, which is not to mean that it is a form of multiple personality disorder. There are positive, negative, and cognitive symptoms to schizophrenia, and schizophrenia is often treated with antipsychotics. The first generation of antipsychotics were dopamine antagonists, specific to the D2 dopamine receptor. The first of these drugs, chlorpromazine, was discovered in the 1950s, and they were meant to target the mesolimbic dopamine system. First-generation antipsychotics reduced positive symptoms, such as manic episodes, but have little effects on the negative and cognitive symptoms, and thus are not perfectly adapted to treating schizophrenia holistically. The action of these drugs led to the dopamine hypothesis of schizophrenia, which states that psychotic episodes are triggered by the activation of dopamine receptors. Later antipsychotics target a mix of dopamine receptors, which have a low affinity for D2 receptors, but a high affinity for D3 and D4 receptors. Now we can take a closer look at Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's, much like schizophrenia, acts on the dopamine system and is mostly centered around a different pathway, the nigrostriatal pathway. It is thought to, in part, be caused by the loss of dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra. Symptoms include tremor, rigidity, and slowness of movement. This reflects the role of the substantia nigra in planning purposeful movement. With the buildup of Lewy bodies in the substantia nigra, there is very extensive dopaminergic neuron cell death. As a consequence, the levels of dopamine in the striatum decrease, as this is where the substantia nigra neurons normally project. Though we can't cure Parkinson's, we can subdue symptoms using drugs such as L-DOPA. L-DOPA is a precursor of dopamine and crosses the blood-brain barrier to boost dopamine synthesis in the remaining dopaminergic neurons of the substantia nigra. This does have a negative consequence. We cannot, so far, target specific areas of the brain with L-DOPA. Ideally, we would want to increase dopamine levels in the caudate nucleus and putamen specifically. But in addition to increasing dopamine in the nigrostriatal pathway, we increase dopamine levels in the other pathways as well. This leads to unwanted side effects such as manic episodes or an increased likelihood for addictive behaviors. This links back to the positive symptoms of schizophrenia, which are thought to be caused by increased dopamine as discussed. This problem works the other way around as well. Administering antipsychotics to schizophrenia patients to decrease dopamine levels can cause Parkinsonian side effects. This shows how integral dopaminergic homeostasis is to the function of our nervous system. Lastly, let's quickly cover attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, also known as ADHD. The role of dopamine in ADHD is less clear. Abnormal genes encoding dopaminergic neuron function have been found in people with ADHD. For example, genes encoding the D4 and D2 receptors, as well as the dopamine transporter. A common drug used to treat ADHD is Ritalin, which among other things inhibits the dopamine transporter. This increases the level of dopamine in the synapse, which may contribute to Ritalin's effect in decreasing impulsiveness and inattention.
Today we talked all about dopamine. We talked about the dopaminergic pathways and their functions, as well as its role in disease, addiction, and reward. I also highlighted some interesting new developments in the field of dopamine research, and if you're interested in reading more about those, I recommend that you look up the papers on the internet. A special thank you to Ferran for being our first guest host here on Brains Discussing Brains, and I'll catch you in the next episode.